is Hazel Khan and Tidings, where I introduce you to people from around the world or who are doing international things. And I bring them to you because you might not otherwise come across them. Today, I'm very pleased and really interested to hear what my guest is going to tell us. Her name is Danica Padilla, and she's somewhere in Western Mass right now, and we're on Skype. I became interested in Danica, who I haven't actually ever met, because she spent some time in Palestine as an activist. So we'll be talking about that, but we'll also be talking about her background and other things that she wants to talk about. So welcome very much. Welcome to Tidings, Danica.
Thank you very much.
I'm curious about your education, because I know it was not a conventional education. You didn't follow the trodden path. Can you just talk a bit about that?
So fairly briefly, most of my life before I started taking college classes, I was homeschooled or unschooled, depending on the term you want to use. I was mainly teaching myself and also taking advantage of resources to learn from other people, whether that was taking a few classes or working with some ecologists when I was doing environmental stuff. I think part of what that allowed me to do was study things from a different perspective than is normally presented in classrooms in schools. I'm not saying all classrooms are all schools, but things like histories that involved revolutionaries and radicals and social movements that otherwise I might not have been able to pursue. And to be curious about and involved in activism from that is something that I think was able to affect the choices I made later on.
And the ecological, yeah, environmental things, was that also, you felt you had more freedom to pursue?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was involved in environmental activism before I was involved with Palestine. The first time I learned really about the Palestinian struggle was probably when I went to an anti-war demonstration on March 20th of, well, I was 13, I'm forgetting the exact year right now. And I saw all these people marching around with Palestinian flags and giving out literature. And I was like, what's going on with this? And started gradually researching and studying the issue from there.
Where did you actually grow up? You're in Massachusetts now. Is that where you also grew up?
Massachusetts, very briefly in Arizona, briefly in New York State. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mostly Western Massachusetts, though.
So the other thing, actually, we mustn't forget to mention is that I actually did hear about you from a mutual acquaintance. Oh, she's a good friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And that's Nora Kramer. You were, I believe, in one of her Yay camps 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
I think 3 years ago. Yeah, mm-hmm. 3 years.
So was that, did that have some influence on you?
Yeah, I mean, it was really inspiring to go there and meet a lot of young activists who were doing really interesting things and were also eager to learn how to be involved in various movements and various struggles.
And when we say young, we're talking about teenagers.
I remember there were other people who were 15 and 16, also 12, 13. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Danica, then what about college and GEDs and things like that? I don't know how that works when you're homeschooled or unschooled.
I was able to go to some classes at the local community college and continue my education that way, which also allowed me to get a legitimate transcript, since I couldn't exactly grade myself for things that I was teaching myself. That would just get a little bit too strange for colleges. Mm-hmm. So in order to apply to college, I took a GED and then was able to get regular federal funding to go to Berkshire Community College. And then I went there for, I guess, a year, and then applied to college and enrolled in Haverford College, which I've taken a rather long break from, but I'm hoping to go back to in the fall.
And so how old were you then when you first were at Haverford?
17.
Mm-hmm. So you have an unusual background. Is it something you'd recommend to other people of your generation or younger than you, that they should pursue such a path?
I would recommend looking beyond the conventional paths, not saying, okay, you have to go to school, then go straight into college, or that you need to do what most people are doing. I think taking time to figure out what you're really interested in and taking time to pursue that outside of normal channels is definitely valuable. I would also tell people, please plan better than I did. I had no idea of how the college application process worked until 6 months before, and then I had to do all the research and all the tests and everything in that time period, and it was a terribly, terribly stressful experience, and I would not recommend to anyone. So there's that piece of advice.
This is something I've always been interested in. For all the unconventional paths that you've taken and ideas that you have, you still feel that it is necessary to have a college degree?
I was lucky enough to get a good financial aid package there. And I mean, there's a lot of things that I think I can learn from that setting and that situation and from the professors, from other people who are studying there. I liked the school when I went. It's not essential. It's not the only way to go. And it's not something that people have to do in order to do what they want to do. But it's something at the moment that I'll probably end up doing. Mm-hmm. Anyways, but yeah, I've definitely talked to people who just learned everything they know through activism and are like, that can make sense also.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Palestine. Was that planned that you went to Palestine?
When I started traveling, when I flew from New York City to Copenhagen, I was hoping to go to Palestine. However, I was hoping to go for the olive harvest and stay for maybe 3 weeks to a month before maybe going off to Jordan and to Egypt and then getting back by the time the next semester started. And that really didn't happen that way. I mean, the olive harvest, it's in October and November when Palestinians across, I mean, the West Bank, Gaza, anywhere where there's agriculture going on, go and have to harvest their olives within this window of time. And because of the way the occupation is structured, especially in the West Bank, I think Palestinians will get attacked by settlers, get barred from accessing their land by the military. So it's become actually this time when there's a lot of international solidarity activists and volunteers who usually go to help with the olive harvest by being there, and they're providing protective presence and also helping to pick the olives. I mean, I wasn't actually able to be a part of that because I got there just when it was ending. It's really important to the Palestinian farmers who depend on it.
They depend on it. This is their livelihood and has been for generations, the olives and the olive oil and all the things that come from that. That's what the occupation is depriving them of, is their traditional livelihood.
Yeah, and in a myriad of ways. I mean, Palestinian farmers are suffering from having just their land taken away outright by the apartheid wall, or if they're farming in areas that are Area C, then they're often barred from their land. For I know farmers in Berin who have about 10 days in the year that they're allowed to go and harvest and plant and seed and like work their land. And that's not only insane, it's also difficult to even manage that. I remember when it was happening in the spring and they were trying to go out and farm their land, we got calls that for, I think it was 4 days in a row, they were stopped from accessing their land by settlers who set up roadblocks, who attacked them from the nearby illegal settlements to try to keep them from being able to access their land. Because in a certain system of laws, if people aren't working or using their land, then the Israeli state can take it away from them. So the Israeli military declares something a closed military zone or keeps people from being able to work that land for a certain number of years. Then after that, they can say people haven't been working the land, therefore we're going to take it and add it to an illegal settlement or something like that, which is, it's one of the strangest, most messed up systems I've heard of for taking land. Driving through the West Bank, you see these settlements popping up everywhere, often quite close to Palestinian villages or right next to refugee camps. There's a settlement right next to Jalazon refugee camp I know in Ramallah, which they've been planning to, I don't know if they've started yet, but they were planning to build yet another wall to steal more of Jalazon's land and quote-unquote protect the settlement that isn't supposed to be there in the first place, according to pretty much all interpretations of international law other than the Israeli states. And I mean, soldiers will say inside Al-Khalil in Hebron, where in the H2 area there's illegal settlements inside of Palestinian neighborhoods, inside a Palestinian city. And there's around 600 settlers, I've heard, and there's at least 2,000 military forces there to protect them. And if you ask a soldier, they'll say, yeah, it's their job to protect the settlers, to protect the Jews, too.
Within Hebron, you mean?
Yeah, that's inside. Mm-hmm. That's where Palestinians are living, too. But the whole apparatus, the police, the military, is set up not for them, just for the settlers.
Let's go back to how you actually got to Palestine. You said you were interested in the olive harvest, but you actually got there too late to participate in it. Talk a little bit about how you decided that that's where you wanted to go.
I think I decided that I wanted to try to go while the war on Gaza was going on in August of 2014. And I was trying to go to as many of the demonstrations as I could. I mean, I think it, like many, many people everywhere in the world, I was absolutely appalled by what was happening. And I had been trying to do some reading and studying around the occupation and around the Palestinian struggle. I wanted to travel in this semester. I was thinking, if I'm going to travel, I knew that if I visited a place and learned from the people who were there, I would learn immeasurably more than just by reading about it. And I knew that there was international solidarity going on in Palestine, and that was a struggle that I really wanted to be a part of if I could, and to get involved in on the ground if I could. So I decided that I was going to try to get there, and I was very afraid that I would be turned away at the airport, and that didn't happen, and it was actually quite unfounded because they don't usually read every single person in the world's emails to figure out whether they're going to try to join a solidarity group.
Especially if they haven't visited Israel before.
Yeah, and especially if they look white.
Yeah. So you got on the plane, you got off at Tel Aviv, at Ben-Gurion Airport. Did you know where to go? Because you weren't actually a member of ISM, right?
They advise people not to contact them beforehand. Mm. So I knew that they had trainings in Ramallah. So I spent a little bit of time in Jerusalem. And then after that, I went to Ramallah and called the number that they gave. And they were like, you know, go to this place. And then we're holding training at these dates. And I showed up. After that, I spent a little over 2 months living in Al-Khalil in Hebron, working with the team there. And we live right in H2. Like literally, there's the apartment. And when you look down, there's military checkpoint, and then up one street is a street where most Palestinians aren't even allowed to pass, and up the other street it also leads to a military base, and then down the street there's another huge checkpoint, and if you take the turn down the street you hit Shuhada Street, which is completely closed to Palestinians. There's a really huge protest about that each year, open Shuhada Street. And then after that, for the last few months I was there, I was doing a lot of media work with ISM, and I was spending a lot of time like based out of Ramallah.
You might have read about all these things, and you might have studied, you know, revolutions and so on, and it's part of your schooling. But what was it like? Was it different for you when you were actually seeing all of this? I mean, I'm just wondering what your frame of mind was. Were you scared? Were you excited? Were you overwhelmed? Just talk about it.
What I'd heard about was what a lot of people hear about, which is something like violence at demonstrations, soldiers shooting at people during demonstrations. I had no understanding of the extent of that, but that's something that I'd heard about. What I didn't really understand any of was what life is like in a place where the military occupation involves soldiers and border police walking up and down the streets all the time, involves Israeli border police shooting tear gas at kids on their way to and from school. Involves arbitrary closures of checkpoints where people can't get home or go to work just because a couple of weeks ago someone threw a Molotov and part of the checkpoint burned down, which had happened slightly before I got there. So after that, they closed the checkpoint for 3 weeks, which meant people had to go up in this circuitous route that involved like going up multiple stairs, cutting through people's backyards, and usually climbing over a couple of walls, which was difficult for, say, me with a really heavy backpack getting there, and could be kind of frustrating for us as activists. But the people who had actually affected were especially young kids and families and elderly people. Mm-hmm. So if someone lived in one of these houses and had trouble climbing over stone walls, then they just couldn't get down into one of the more busy and economically important neighborhoods near where they lived.
Do you think it makes people more cooperative, you know, that they are more helpful to each other to help you get down the wall from the wall, or is it all every man for himself?
People have to work together and help each other how they can. I mean, these are communities of people facing the occupation. So actually, when you're walking up and down these muddy paths and walls, I often found people like being very polite and nice to each other. What else can they do, and what else could we do? The checkpoint was closed.
How is it in terms of acceptance of the activists, wherever you were? Is there any suspicion, resentment, that kind of thing, or gratitude? Or, you know, I'm just wondering what the relationship is with the occupied people, the Palestinians, and international outsiders who come for varying periods of time, who understand the situation, but they're outsiders. I just wonder if you can talk about that, what you experienced.
Yeah, I mean, it's complex. When I went and worked with the team first in Al-Khalil, one of the things that really did seem to be working was that they knew all the people in the neighborhood, and the people knew like where we lived and the kind of things that we did, and people would call when something was happening. It's a measure of if we were doing our work properly, if people would call for something like someone's getting arrested, someone's getting harassed, can you come? There was definitely situations, though, where we knew, like, there was suspicion or, I mean, if you're a random foreigner who doesn't speak Arabic properly, wandering around with a whole bunch of kids who or just live in this really, really rough situation and are being attacked by the military on a regular basis, they're not immediately like, hey, friends, they're going to be kind of suspicious of what's going on.
Teenage activist Danika Padija is describing what she saw, heard, and felt during her 5 months of activism in Palestine. This is Hazel Khan bringing you Tidings on WPKN Radio.
I was talking actually more with the kids. It was more the places where we went to do these school runs, like monitoring the checkpoints where they were walking to and from school, military was. I mean, all of these neighborhoods are, I think you would call, rough. But the bad element is all these 18 to 20-odd-year-olds with M16s.
The Israeli soldiers.
And, of course, the settlers who have attacked Palestinians, attacked a kid that I knew, not while I was there, actually, while I was in Ramallah, but I would remember this showing up in the news. And if you see, you know, a kid getting attacked by adults with a pointed metal object, it's appalling no matter the circumstance. But I remember realizing and looking at the picture and being like, I know that kid, like I know his family. I played with his sister and his brother. This is happening to kids and their families all the time.
So it becomes personal in a way.
Yeah, it becomes more personal. And being there really drove home that things are happening all the time, not just when something comes up in the news, not just when someone gets shot and killed and maybe that'll come up in the news, or some big new legislation is going on in the Knesset and maybe that'll come out in the news, but just people's houses getting demolished every day, or kids getting tear gassed on their ways to school, or soldiers invading a refugee camp, or checkpoints getting closed and people not being able to go to work. People will never hear about that in the U.S. And I don't think I had any kind of understanding of it before I actually lived there.
How did that make you feel about the Israelis, the soldiers and the settlers? Whether you changed the way you felt about them or how you feel about them today?
We spent a lot of time trying to reason with soldiers. Occasionally you can get people through checkpoints most of the time. It gets to the point of them saying things like, I am the law, I belong to the most moral army in the world, after you've seen them arresting and beating up people and kids, which would be ludicrous if it wasn't just so sad and so tragic and frustrating. And yeah, I really hated the occupation and the instruments of it before I got to Palestine, but it's a completely different feeling after talking to the people who've been affected by it and being affected even in a slight way myself. I know what I experienced was just a tiny sliver and can't even approach what Palestinians experience who live there all the time. But I would be angry at individual soldiers, especially in the moment. It's not even the individual soldiers who are the worst part of the problem. It's thinking about the kind of structure that puts these people who should be in college. I looked at them, they were, you know, the same age as my college classmates, sometimes younger, giving them M16s and guns that shoot tear gas and rubber-coated metal bullets and stun grenades and pepper spray, and giving them absolute power over the lives of people whose language they don't even understand in many cases, whose neighborhoods they have no conception of, whose lives they have no conception of. I mean, it's a recipe for oppression, and it's a recipe for the ongoing disaster and catastrophe that is the lives of Palestinians.
You sound angry and you sound outraged, but also you sound a bit as if you're in despair. I mean, is that accurate? Has your experience made you more or less optimistic, pessimistic, or is that not even a good question?
I don't know. People will say often, this is complicated, this conflict, this Palestinian-Israeli issue is complicated. In one sense, after going there, I have a very clear sense that it's not complicated. Mm. It's occupation, oppression, and colonization, and that is not complicated. Coming up with some kind of solution, constructing a response, like getting a way out of this, that is extremely complicated. Mm. And I don't know how that's going to work. I mean, I know that people internationally need to keep on putting pressure and put much, much more pressure on the Israeli government and on its supporters to see that this is just unacceptable, that continuing to remain complicit in this, as people in the United States and in countries that are continuing to fund and give weapons and give diplomatic support to the Israeli government are, being complicit in this is unacceptable. I mean, I don't know about pessimism or optimism, but I know it's left me with an enormous obligation to try to change this.
I was going to ask you that in a slightly different way. Is this something you will continue being involved with? I mean, one possibility might be that you just, you know, you're interested in these theories of oppression and revolution and so on, so you might just go elsewhere next time you travel. You might go to another country where, God knows, there's a lot of choice of countries you could go to. Or has this made you have some sort of special commitment to the Palestinians?
I do have a different kind of commitment to that, and it's not because that its struggle is more important than anyone else. There are worse things happening in other situations, and there are different struggles that need support also, and it's not the only place to participate in resistance like that either. But I have a commitment to it because people there let me into their lives and told me what was happening to them, and then said, people outside need to know this. People in the United States, people need to know this and participate in ending it.
Do you feel that your work is more important than outside the country, than in it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, mobilizing international support and trying to get more people involved with boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and putting pressure on the state of Israel and on the U.S. government, which is a huge, huge supporter of the occupationists. I'm sure most people know, but people I talk to there, and actually in the training, they say that 20% of the work that you do is inside Palestine and 80% is outside. Because inside, I mean, a lot of what you're doing is learning. Even if you're trying to help in participating in concrete ways, you're not going to fix anything inside Palestine. The Palestinian struggle is Palestinian-led. It's being conducted by the Palestinian people, and internationals can play a role in that. But it's not the same kind of role that we can play as outside. Taking what we learn outside is more important than anything that we could do inside. I mean, we can't stop people from getting killed, and we can't stop the occupation. It isn't something that a bunch of people from countries around the world can do.
What do you think you will do?
I want to connect with the people who are organizing around Palestinian and anti-imperialist issues and environment and everything else that I care about here. I mean, I know when this airs, May 13th? Yeah, it's 2 days before Nakba Day, which is a commemoration by Palestinian people and supporters around the world of all the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were forcibly expelled and hundreds who were killed in 1947, 1948.
So that the State of Israel could be created.
Yeah, and I hope to be involved with protests and demonstrations, this action around that, and I would urge anyone who's listening who also wants to get involved to find out what's happening on that day and try to get involved, as well as participating in boycott, divestment, and sanctions. There was a call put out by Palestinian civil society quite a number of years ago, and it's boycott directed towards companies that are profiting off of Israeli human rights violations and the occupation of Palestine, not buying certain products, a consumer boycott, to divesting. There's been a lot of colleges and universities in the United States and also in other countries that have divested their investments and their endowments from Israel and the companies that, like military contractors and other companies that support human rights violations, which is really, really good and really big. I remember being really happy to hear about that while I was in Palestine, hearing about the votes going on in all the different universities.
Do you feel you have been changed dramatically by this experience of living amongst the Palestinians in the middle of the occupation? Do you feel that people listen to you? I mean, have you become an authority or a leader or anything like that because of this or not?
I don't know. I mean, I think I can tell people things that other people may not be able to tell them. I can tell people stories that I heard from there. I can tell people stories about getting shot at in demonstrations or getting dreadfully tear gassed for marching down the street holding flags. I can do that. I don't feel like very much of an authority. Frankly, I'm not very much of an authority because really the people who are authorities on this are Palestinians who are living in it and involved in the struggle. And people seeking to learn more should definitely like find books or speeches or talks by Palestinian voices. I'm trying to speak to as many people about this as possible, because after I came back, it's an important part of the role that I have here.
What has changed? How have you changed? Or maybe you haven't.
I think before I went, I had a kind of intellectual, mental commitment to being involved with activism. I had ideas about what I wanted to do. I had thought about it. I had read things. I had marched in large demonstrations in the United States. But I think after coming back, my motivation is much more concrete. My commitment has changed. I'm trying to be involved in changing this situation and these kinds of situations around the world.
You actually were arrested, so you do know firsthand what tear gas is like.
Yeah, I mean, the experience of my arrest was very mild compared to what most Palestinians and also other international activists has experienced. But I was at a demonstration in Turmusaya a week and a half after the minister Ziad Abu Ayn was killed. Mm. What the demonstration I was at was in part trying to do was complete the olive tree planting that had begun at that earlier demonstration. So I was with a group of Palestinians and internationals and also Israeli activists that were trying to plant these olive trees. And while they were planting olive trees, the military started throwing stun grenades at everyone. Stun grenades that were landing literally right next to an olive tree that someone was trying to plant. Someone's hand was injured. When I got close, they grabbed me. And when I tried to get away from them, they like shoved my face into the ground and arrested me along with the other Palestinians who were also violently handled and an Israeli activist. And then in a brilliant example of how the justice system is completely two-tiered or multi-tiered, the Israeli was released quite early on after we were taken to the police station in the nearby settlement. And then she refused to leave until they released me as well. So I was released a bit after midnight with conditions to not be in the West Bank. And the two Palestinians were taken to Muscovia prison because Afer military prison was full at the time. Usually they would be taken to Afer. And then they were held there for, I think, a couple of days. And then they went to court and were both released on a few thousand shekels bail. I don't remember the exact amount at the time. They keep firing tear gas after someone's injured. They fire tear gas at ambulances, at journalists, at young kids, at everyone.
I'm really glad that you agreed to talk to us, because now you've brought the occupation basically to our radio waves. And this is not an experience that most people will have. And you've had the experience and you've brought it with you lucidly. So thank you very much, Danica. Thank you, very much for your time. Is there anything else that you'd like to say to our audience?
The only thing is to make really clear that people don't have to go to Palestine to be involved. Doing work here in the U.S. is extremely important, and trying not to be complicit in what's going on, and don't let the U.S. government continue to support these appalling Israeli violence, military occupation, human rights violations in your names. Don't let that keep happening.
That's very good advice. Thank you very much, Danica, for being here.
Thank you for talking with me.
You've been listening to teenage activist Danica Padija, who's recently returned from 5 months of activism in Palestine. You can hear Tidings at 7:30 p.m. on the second Wednesday of every month on WPKN and WPKN.org. Tidings is produced by Tony Ernst and archived as podcasts on hazelkahn.com.